Hello and welcome to the Penn Innovators and Business Network. Today we have with us Mr. John Steinberg, the current president of Altice USA News and Advertising. John is also the founder of Cheddar, the former CEO of Daily Mail, and of course the former president of BuzzFeed. He's a Disney Imagineer, real estate analyst, an internet entrepreneur, a Booz Allen consultant, a stockbroker, a Googler, a venture capitalist, a BuzzFeeder, and an entrepreneur. Welcome to the interview, John. Today's interview is dedicated to the Basser Center for BRCA. The Basser Center is the first comprehensive center for the research, treatment, and prevention of BRCA-related cancers. John, how did you know about the BRCA?
Well, my wife, Jill, went to Penn, and so we're very involved with Penn. And she has the BRCA genetic mutation, which is highly correlated with breast cancer and other kinds of cancers. And so Jill serves on the board of the advisory board of the Basser Center at Penn, and we've kind of donated a lot of our philanthropic other efforts towards helping them find a cure for these kind of genetic mutations. So the Basser Center is very close to our hearts, and Penn is close to our hearts. And so it made a lot of sense for us to give any funds that you raised to the Basser Center.
So without further ado, John, how did this all start as a Disney Imagineer?
Well, I basically wrote them a letter. I saw on an early dial-up bulletin board system that they were looking for people to become Imagineers. And I filled out a questionnaire online, this is pre-internet, and wrote an essay with a bunch of ideas that I had. And I got a call from Imagineering, and they basically hired me to be an intern, and I just did gopher type work and, you know, basic help out type stuff during summers and school breaks. And I did that from the time that I was in 10th grade, right around until I was entering college. So it was about a 3-4 year type experience. And, you know, I always wanted to be a Disney Imagineer, so it was incredible.
And you were only 15 at this time?
I was 15, yeah. I was 15 at the time.
That's so interesting. And at this time, who was your role model?
You know, my role model has really always been my dad. You know, my father is a very successful real estate broker. He changed his career from being a doctor to being a real estate broker. So that always inspired me that you can reinvent yourself. He's always been an incredible negotiator. And I grew up watching him through his various entrepreneurial ventures. And so he was always the one that inspired me. And then the other person that you know, the more public figure would probably be Walt Disney. I mean, I've always been kind of obsessed with all that he created out of thin air, basically, even before computers. The ability to build Disneyland and Disney World is pretty incredible when you think about all the technology we have today and what they didn't have back then. And so I would always say it's kind of a combination of my father and Walt Disney.
Do you think the media side of your interests stem from Walt Disney?
No, the video stuff sort of came later. I mean, I was always interested in media and technology, and I've always been interested in computers. The video stuff really happened when I started doing a lot of CNBC while I was at BuzzFeed, and I became obsessed with the efficiency of live video production, and I felt like there weren't a lot of people working in that area. And so when I decided I wanted to start my own company, I knew I wanted to do something in live video just because I felt like there had been so little competition there and so little innovation. And so that's really when the video stuff started for me, which was, you know, it's after I'd left BuzzFeed. We did some BuzzFeed, you know, video type stuff on YouTube, but my real passion for it came when it was time to start my own company.
Interesting. We will get to that, very, very soon. But after becoming an Imagineer, then you went to Princeton. And if you could redo college, what do you think you would change?
Yeah, I think, you know, they offered me to kind of go work at Disney straight out of high school, right? And to skip college or delay college. And I really wish that I had done that. And then the other thing I wish I had done is, you know, I got into Stanford too. And I wish I had gone to Stanford instead of Princeton, because there was so much technology innovation going on out in the Valley during that period of time. It's when all the startups were really getting going in the internet. And so, you know, Princeton was okay, but I don't feel like it was the best use of my time for 4 years, given what I wanted to do. I mean, I got a heck of a rigorous education there. I mean, the workload was enormous. I took hard classes, loved some of my professors, but I feel like I should have either worked for Imagineering instead of going to college, or at least put off college, or gone to Stanford. But, you know, the whole idea of what would you do differently, you know, is sort of a waste of time to think that way, really, because, you know, you always end up where you are because of what you've done. And I've had a very kind of meandering, weaving path. I'm happy where I am now. And I guess that, you know, I can't really make any complaints about the decisions that I made. You know, I mean, I'm not really big for looking backwards.
And at this point, you've gotten into Princeton, you've gotten a Disney Imagineer job, which is incredible. And then you've gotten to Stanford too. Is there anything during college that broke the success streak?
No, where the success streak really broke for me was after I graduated. After I graduated college and kind of through business school, my career sort of went sideways at that point. You know, I mean, I had done some interesting things, but, you know, I basically found myself after business school in my mid to late 20s working at Booz Allen on just boring, horrible projects in office parks in the middle of nowhere, working on very mundane type stuff. And I felt a little bit like someone who was a child star who had had all this early success and then it had all sort of petered out. And then basically it took me a very long period of time to get back to doing something really creative. And I would say that that was my work at BuzzFeed, which really didn't happen until I was, you know, in my mid to late 30s and had already had my first child and all of these types of things. So it took me a long time. I mean, I didn't have the success of BuzzFeed until I was in my late 30s, and I didn't start my company until I was 40. And so that early success took a long time to regain, and I had a lot of kind of mediocrity and, you know, boring type stuff going on basically for a large period of time in my 20s and 30s.
I think that mediocrity and the feeling of not everything's going all right is something that a lot of college students, including me, experienced during college and throughout their life. How have you been able to mentally, emotionally get through those challenges?
You know, I never really gave up, I guess. I never really gave up. And I always tried things. And I tried to get a job at Foursquare. And I tried to get a job at Twitter. And I built little things on their APIs. And I tried to, you know, always cold email people and tried to make my way in the world. And so, you know, I think there were probably periods of 6 months or a year where I was just stuck at Booz Allen, or I was just stuck being a stockbroker and things weren't really going the way that I wanted to. But I always imagined that I could figure something out at some point. You know, there's a quote that Martin Sorrell has, he talks about, that his father had said to him, which is, you know, no matter how dark the storm, you must feel no fear, right? And, you know, look, I worry plenty of times and I feel plenty of fear, I guess, but I try to live up to that idea. I try to live up to the idea that, you know, even in the darkest moments, or even in the moments of the most defeat, you know, you'll figure something out. You can figure something out if you try.
If you would expand on that, what was the lowest moment in that period and how did you get through it?
The lowest moment of my career was working for Booz Allen. I mean, you know, I'd gone there to work on media projects. They put me on a defense project. I went down to Northern Virginia. I worked in a dark office building where my job was to make up PowerPoint slides about how paper should be moved through the NSA. And then every evening I went back to a hotel across the street, and then it was just back and forth like that. And then I flew out on Thursday night or Friday morning, I flew home, and it was just, I was doing work that was terribly boring. I didn't think it was important. I had gone to Princeton, I'd had the Disney experience, I'd gone to business school, and now I was doing this. And it felt to me in that moment like, you know, how do I get my way out of here? And I kind of, you know, I think I sulked about it for a while. And then I left Booz Allen after 10 months just because I realized that it was, you know, they had sort of traded me a bill of goods, I think. It was not the job they had promised. I wasn't doing what I wanted to do. And I found work at my first startup. And that's when I joined. My first startup was after Booz Allen. It was called Majestic Research. It was an independent research firm. And then I kind of got the startup bug from having done that.
You mentioned in one of the interviews that you post all of the criticisms and negative things you have on your wall.
Not all. But there was an article in Adweek that was written about how bad BuzzFeed was and that BuzzFeed was never going to be successful. And that, you know, it criticized my personality and said that I was too intense and a whole bunch of other things. And once BuzzFeed became successful, I kind of thought about that article and I framed it and I put it on my wall. And because I did it for two reasons, which is that, you know, you're basically, I think, in two phases in life. Basically, everybody thinks you're the worst or everybody thinks you're the greatest, right? And I've lived through numerous times of that cycle. I've been fired numerous times, and, you know, I've had people think I'm the greatest entrepreneur. I've had people think that my ideas are the stupidest and I'm the worst entrepreneur. And so I think that, you know, in the moments when you're on top, it's good to remember that, you know, it is always a cycle like this. You're always on top one day and the bottom the next, then you can be on top the day after that. And so I like to I like to remember the criticism. And also I like people to know that I don't really get high on my own supply, that I never really believe that I'm as good as people say that I am. And I never really believe that I'm as bad as people say that I am either.
I think that's humbleness and ability to understand that is very important. And as you were working on these different projects, you first started off with BuzzFeed, then you went to Daily Mail, then you went to Found Cheddar.
Yes.
So throughout all of this journey, is there one takeaway from each of these startups or each of these leadership positions that you learned that could be very good advice for students?
Yeah, I think that you got to continually reinvent yourself. You know, I joined BuzzFeed, there was 15 employees. My job was to sell advertising. And then by the time I left, I think we had like 500 people and I was running most of the business. And so you've got to continually up-level yourself and become somebody new and reinvent yourself and reinvent what you're doing. And if you try to stay the same, you won't be able to do what's needed for the next phase of the journey. And, you know, Daily Mail, I had to learn about, you know, operating in a much bigger company. And then BuzzFeed, then Cheddar, I had to go back to kind of starting from scratch. And then now at Altice, I run a really big division. And so I had to kind of go back to learning how to be in a big company and drive a much bigger boat. And then we had to, you know, adapt to COVID, which changed basically everything. So I think that flexibility, reinvention, I often say that the change is the elixir of life. And the people that can kind of ride change like a wave and get used to change and feel comfortable with it and recognize that is always the steady state. Change is always the most common state that you're going to be in business. I think that those people tend to do better than people that are scared of change, because there's no getting around change. Change is always going to be there. It's going to be there every single day of your existence, you know, in especially kind of entrepreneurial work.
I understand change is the steady state of existence, but some change seems almost too big. You were the CEO of Daily Mail, then you went to start a very, very small startup at that time, Cheddar. Yeah. What made you make that decision?
I just really wanted to do my own thing, and I had been an early employee at BuzzFeed, but it was never my company. I wasn't the founder. And I wanted to have a shot at trying to invent something myself. And I didn't want to ask anybody's permission. And I wanted it to be successful or fail based on whether I could figure it out or not, and whether the team that I built could figure it out with me. And, you know, that was always a craving that I had. I think that I've been on this journey of seeking out freedom, you know, freedom of creativity, freedom to do what I want to do. And that I think has come to be, you know, one of my highest values is the ability to kind of just do what I want to do. But the people listening to this, you got to remember, it took me 40 years to get there, right? So, you know, I think that, you know, no one on this call should be starting a company fresh out of college. Like, that's not, I mean, yeah, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, fine. I mean, you come up with a couple examples, right? But like most of the time, there's a lot to learn. And if you want to do a startup, you need to work as an employee at a startup before you found your own startup. That's just a necessary step to get the credibility with the investors and the credibility with the people that you're going to want to be able to hire and build a team around.
Yes. And then after this, as a leader of these three separate companies, what have you learned as a leader that students like us who are going into large scale companies as followers?
You have two jobs, basically. Your job is to do what you're asked to do. And then your job is in your free time to invent and come up with things that move the business forward without being asked to do it. And more than just writing down a bunch of ideas, actually coming up with a plan, building a prototype, pulling together people to kind of mock or sketch something out. And those are the people that are really successful in companies, people who do what they're asked to do and then go above and beyond to create value for the company through kind of, you know, when they're not asked to do so. But you really only can do that if you're doing your day job. So your day job is to do what you're told and your night job is to invent and create something bigger.
And how do you know where to start inventing, where to start benefiting the company?
Yeah, well, if I knew that, I wouldn't need to ask somebody else to do it, right? I mean, that's really the enigma of the thing, which is, you know, you're in these companies, you're young, you guys have fresh ideas. If the leadership had all of the ideas and all the solutions, they wouldn't need to hire people. And team members need to do the tasks the company needs, and then they need to be able to push forward new ideas that the company hasn't thought of because the company can't think of those new ideas. So that really is the riddle that you need to solve.
I see. And as students, do you have any advice for undergraduates or graduates going into the job market during the COVID period? Is there anything from hiring at all these three companies that you look for?
Yeah, what I would say is that it's a very long road. A career is a very long road. An entrepreneurial journey is a very long and winding road. And, you know, this is going to be a very hard time to get jobs, but it was a very hard time to get a job, you know, in 2003, when I was graduating business school, it was a very hard time to get a job. In 2008, it was a very hard time to get a job. And so these periods come. Try to find the best job you can that lines up the best with your interests. It won't be the perfect job, but just, you know, do it with excellence, do your best work, and then kind of take things as they come and then look for the next opportunity. But I think that for most students, you know, now you won't be able to be too picky just because the world is in such distress right now.
I see. And how did you go about it? You graduated in 1999, I think, that right after the dot-com bubble. How did you find your first job?
I went to the Booz Allen job. It was a horrible job. And then I was able to find a job at a startup that I liked. And I always kept my ears open and I always networked and I always looked around and I always emailed people and I always looked at where jobs were open. And so I had a very winding path and I kind of took opportunities as they came my way. And there was a lot of imperfect things that I did, imperfect jobs that weren't the ideal fit, but they were the best fit I could find at the time. And I just always put one foot in front of the other. And that's why I've done as many things as you kind of rattled off in your opening list there. But, you know, it's the perfect is the enemy of the good, right? Which is, you know, you may find a good job. You're never going to find the perfect job. You're going to have to go through 10 jobs before you find the one that really sticks or the thing you really want to do.
I'm very curious. Cheddar grew as a very, very small network. How did Cheddar start off growing the audience and growing the network?
It took us 3 years to get the carriage that we wanted on all of the skinny bundles, Hulu, YouTube TV, Sling, Fubo, Philo, all those different platforms. And Sling, you know, I met Charlie Ergen at an event. I followed him into the bathroom. He runs Dish. I asked him, I told him what I wanted to create. I asked him if I created it, would he put it on Sling? He said, yeah, if you're able to create that, you know, that kind of content. So then we started doing it. We broadcast just on Facebook in the beginning. We were able to show people that we delivered on what we said we would build. And then we were able to get carriage on some of these systems. And then as we got more carriage, it kind of built upon itself. But it was really, again, it was a 3-year effort to get Cheddar put on all the different systems. And then we did a bunch of other kinds of things too. Like we created all these gadget videos that worked really well on Instagram and LinkedIn. So we modified our content so that it would work on the various platforms as well too. So, you know, the best thing you can do to earn credibility is to tell someone you're going to do something and then go and do it and then go back to them and say, remember when I said I would do that, I did that. And then that creates credibility more than almost anything you can do.
I see. And at the beginning, Cheddar was seen as the CNBC for millennials. And yeah. 2 years later, you opened a headline news channel and network. Right. And then now just early July, you sent a message saying that Cheddar 2.0 will be a mixture of both of them. What led to the transitions?
You know, really COVID did. And we recognized that we did do a layoff, right? We had too many people for the ad market as it contracted for COVID. So we needed to make some changes. And then the other thing we recognized was that these free TV systems like Pluto, Roku Channel, Zumo were growing much faster than the pay TV platforms like Sling and Hulu. We really wanted to double down and put our best content in these free platforms. So combining allowed us to reduce the headcount, to adjust to the macroeconomic impact of COVID. And then at the same time, to kind of adjust the platform for this kind of growing free TV type ecosystem that we wanted to move our bet towards. Because the pay TV skinny bundles ultimately didn't grow as much as we had hoped that they would. Sling TV and YouTube TV and Hulu Live and all of those, they didn't grow as big as I had thought they would grow. And meanwhile, Roku Channel and Pluto and Zumo were growing like a weed, basically. And so I wanted to reconfigure our bet and double down on that stuff.
So what is your bets for the future of media?
I think that people will get their premium dramas and comedies through SVOD services like Netflix and HBO Max and Disney Plus. And I think that there will be enormous demand for live free content that will be in news and sports and kind of general house and garden type entertainment. And I think that people will have faster and faster pipes into their homes. At Altice, we're actually rolling out fiber to the home now. I think that people will quickly all have a gig in their home. And they'll play online games, they'll stream dramas and comedies, they'll stream their live news through a variety of free services. And I think you look a couple of years out and that's really what the ecosystem looks like, I think.
And traditional cable television, what will happen to that?
traditional cable television is of enormous value, and the bundle is beloved by many people and is still an incredibly important business for us, but it's not a growth business. And that's, you know, that's basically a fact that our, you know, the broadband for every major cable company is growing and the video take is declining, right? And so that is in some ways, you know, a melting ice cube. It's not going to go away fast because a lot of people still value the convenience and ease of use of a multi-channel bundle. But I suspect that all of you graduating are going to get broadband, but very few of you are going to get a cable box, if any of you get a cable box. So it's just a transition that's going on right now.
Interesting. Cheddar has a live network for the entire day. And compared to like the new trend of TikTok, which is like 10 seconds, why do you choose to have a longer form content?
That's a concept that I wanted to create. And, you know, people want to watch short, snackable content. It's usually user-generated content. You know, I guess if I come up with the idea for TikTok, I'd be super happy right now, but it's not really something for professional media. Although we actually have 1 million followers on TikTok and we do create content for TikTok. I think TikTok will be very successful. In some ways, it fills the need that I think Quibi wanted to fill, which is people, you know, grabbing short content on the go. But, you know, we've seen many iterations of that. There was Vine before, and, you know, there's been several different iterations of the short form, 6 second type stuff. And Instagram in some ways is like that as well too, even though obviously it's not quite as short. But what's been successful there has mostly been kind of homegrown creators and not really professional media companies. If Cheddar hadn't worked, it would have meant that all these systems that people were consuming content on never came into being and the consumption never came there. And that basically everybody continued to watch traditional linear cable television. Mm-hmm. And we saw, you know, and that would have been the bet. That would have been the failure of the bet, that the distribution would not have changed. We would have been too early. I mean, that's really the primary reason why the bet would have failed if it failed. In fact, we got the bet right. But, you know, in all of these things, you're always placing these kind of bets.
I see. And that brings us into the Q&A section with questions submitted by our guests and students. The first question comes from
somebody you might know. It is from Professor Paul Starr, a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton, who
Amazing.
Teaches a seminar on the history of communication technologies.
Yeah, of course. I love Professor Starr.
Yes. You were one of the students in his class, and I contacted him to see if he had any questions for you. So his question is very, very interesting. The long antitrust suit against IBM opened a way for Microsoft, and the antitrust suit against Microsoft helped open a way for Google. So now if there's an antitrust suit against Google, who might that open the way for?
I think the history of these antitrust things has actually been, you know, mistaken by and large. You know, the antitrust breakup of Microsoft really kind of just threw Microsoft into disarray for many years. And he's right, it opened the way to Google. You know, I think that there are areas that venture capitalists just don't invest in because of Google, right? And ultimately, I think that, you know, when you look at the amount of areas that Google is successful in right now, like cloud computing and online documents and search and the like, it's very hard to get a toehold in there. However, we are seeing, you know, we see companies like Basecamp, and we see companies like, you know, the new email app Superhuman that everybody's excited about. And there is competition that enters into it. So ultimately, I think that these antitrust actions tend to be misguided, and they tend to just really do damage to the existing company and ensure that that existing company can't continue to effectively compete. And I feel like competition comes naturally even without those efforts. So I guess that's a long way of saying that I think that there's always been, you know, Google is, you know, what, 10 years old or something like that, right? So look at what they've accomplished in such a short period of time. Look what Twitter's accomplished in a short period of time. You know, Facebook didn't stop Twitter from happening, right? And so I generally think you don't need these actions unless the company is really doing something, a restraint on trade or a restraint on competition. But in most cases, they're just successful.
The second question is, going back to BuzzFeed, what did you do when you started out that others didn't do that enabled you to rise to the top? And if you could share a personal story or two that helps explain how this could happen to you.
Yeah, so I'll tell you. I mean, first of all, nobody wanted to work at BuzzFeed because BuzzFeed was not a hot company in 2010. Everybody wanted to work at Foursquare. And so when I got the opportunity to go there to be the business builder, I took it because it was the only opportunity that was open. Nobody else wanted to do that at BuzzFeed. The other thing I did was a lot of times when someone comes into a company with a founder, they tell the founder everything that they need to change in order to be able to make the business monetizable or generate revenue. And I did the opposite. I said, I'll come in and I'll sell what you have. I'll learn to sell advertising. I'll learn to generate some monetization. And so those were the two things that I brought. And then once I had generated some monetization, I raised ideas and changes that I thought we needed to make. But starting out of the gate, I just brought value. And I think that's really the key. You pick a company that nobody else wants to work for and you bring value right away.
And this goes back to your point of, as a worker, you should first focus on doing your job, then creating new ideas.
Exactly. Or do both at the same time, but just make sure you're doing your job.
Has there been an example of somebody who has done that for you in a company that you really are impressed by?
Well, I've had this partner now of, I guess, close to 7 years, a guy named Eric Harris, who's been my operational right hand at BuzzFeed and at Cheddar. And Eric continues to do that, which is he operates the business. He's the chief operating officer. And then he's continually looking at ways to create growth and opportunity for us. So yes, I mean, I think that that's exactly the kind of person and people that I try to surround myself with.
The next question is, outside of your family, has there been anybody who has been a significant mentor to you?
I had two mentors at Disney when I was an Imagineer, a guy named Dave Fink and a guy named Trevor Bryant. And they taught me the line that I gave you. You know, I went to Dave when I was hired as an intern at Imagineering and I said, you know, what should I do? And he said, if I knew what you should do, I would have just done it myself and not hired you. And so, you know, I learned a lot of lessons there about creativity and figuring things out and bringing value. And so, you know, also I had another mentor, Jerry Spire, the real estate developer, who taught me about negotiation and business deals and basically taught me, you know, you only get one reputation. And when you shake someone's hand on a deal, you're bound to that deal, even if you decide later you don't like that deal. So I picked up a lot of good chestnuts, I call them, kind of from almost every single person that I worked for or I was exposed to when I was in my, you know, teens and early 20s.
I see. And the next question is from Wharton Senior, David. What were some challenges and hurdles during the meteoric rise of BuzzFeed?
Well, we had, you know, what I always say about BuzzFeed is I had two bad years and two good years. So I got there 2010, and Jonah's bet was that Facebook would send enormous amounts of social traffic to the kind of content we were creating. And my bet was that native advertising or advertorials would really take off. And from 2010 to 2012, that was not going so well. Those were our bets. Neither one of them was clicking. And then in 2013, Facebook started sending tons of traffic to the quizzes and the BuzzFeed articles and stuff. And the advertiser demand for native content and us creating branded content for them became enormous. So I had 2 years where every board meeting was torture and I went home every night thinking I was getting fired. Then I had 2 years where, you know, everything I did was perfect, basically. And so, you know, that goes back to where we sort of began the conversation, which is really in the 2 years that the board thought I was the worst, you know, I never thought I was the worst. I thought that I was just trying to figure stuff out and it was a hard problem to solve and we were struggling and it was what it was. And then 2 years later, you know, everyone on the board and everyone would always say, oh, we need to find someone like John Steinberg for this company or that company because he's the best at doing this stuff. And so, you know, I'm lucky, I think, that those first 2 years were so hard because, you know, look, I don't think of myself as someone who can get a big ego, but I, you know, any person can get a big ego and anybody can get an inflated sense of self. Had it the first 2 years, everybody told me how great I was. Maybe I would have believed I was so great. You know what I mean? But I had 2 years before where the same people were telling me that I was terrible. So basically when they told me I was great, I kind of knew that, you know, approval and things like that are fickle and they change with time. You know, that's a bit about my time, my hurdles at BuzzFeed.
And I know there's a viral marketing class at Penn, and then the second lesson or third lesson is they want everybody to make a BuzzFeed quiz and then launch it and then see who can get the most views. What was the secret, if you can tell us, of getting people to share?
It was just creating a lot of content. I mean, that was, you know, the secret was really creating enormous amounts of content that you thought would work on Facebook, and then some of it did work on Facebook. I mean, that really, that's as much the secret as it is anything. And then continually adjusting and creating new formats that would, you know, we did GIFs before anybody was doing GIFs, and then we did the quizzes before anyone was doing the quizzes, and then we did the, you know, Jonah was constantly coming up with new formats and testing them. So it was as much about kind of testing and trying as it was hitting on any one perfect thing.
Okay. Our next question is from Catherine Lee. How did you build your initial team for Cheddar? Do you have any advice for finding optimal business partners?
Well, this is why it's so important to be part of a successful startup before starting your own company, which is I was really able to pull a lot of great people that we had worked with at BuzzFeed, who had been great teammates of mine, to come and be teammates at Cheddar. And so I was able to build off of the BuzzFeed alumni network in a way. And so that's why you really have to build a deep network of people that you know in the kind of startup world, so that when you go to find your founding team, you're able to pull from people that, you know, think you have credibility and have worked with you before and understand how you work, because those first few hires, you're really going to have to source through your network. And so that's how we did it with BuzzFeed.
Were there any
mistakes in hiring, and how did you address that?
Yeah, there's always mistakes in hiring. And obviously I'm not going to talk about individual people, but what, you know, one of the things I will tell you about people is that, you know, the person you hire is not necessarily the same person a year later. The people go through changes in their life that affects their performance. And so people either have to adjust with the business, or changes in their personal life make them a different person. And so then they're less or more successful. But yeah, you know, look, you have to be able to fire people. I mean, that's a really important part of the business. You've got to give timely feedback. You can't just fire someone one day with no process or reasoning. You need to go through an orderly kind of feedback process, and you need to give feedback continually in documented forums. And then, you know, if people are not right for the business, or the business is not right for them, you need to have the ability to separate them from the company.
By increasing the team size, did that lead to a change in organizational culture?
It's a very good question. It's very hard to keep the intensity of that first 10 or 15 people. And as you build out the organization, people own less equity. They feel less like founders. They want a great job. They're committed to the vision. Hopefully they love the company, you know, all of those different types of things. But you know, not everybody is going to want to make their entire life the company. Some people are just going to want to have a job. And, you know, that was difficult for me to adjust to. I think that when we got to 50 or 100 people at Cheddar, the fact that like not everybody lived and breathed it as much as I did, and, you know, just wanted great orderly jobs with a work-life balance, was hard for me to adjust to. But I grew and I figured it out. I think I grew and I figured it out. But yes, there is a change that goes on in each one of these stages, where it's no longer like the founding team that owns a lot of the company, that feels like the company's success is their success. You know, you do lose some of that as you get into a bigger team. Mm.
And what is the next step for Cheddar? What is next step for Altice USA and Cheddar as a part of it?
Well, we have our news channels. We have News 12, which is our hyperlocal news networks. We have our local advertising sales. And, you know, I think the next step for us is to figure out, coming out of COVID, how do we serve our clients differently? How do we serve our advertisers differently? What do we do with our news to adopt, to change to consumption habits as they've been kind of, you know, changed dramatically with COVID? I mean, this was a year that I thought we would go into that would be about kind of inventing new things. And it's become more of a year of kind of trying to predict and figure out and adjust to all of the changes in the world. And so I think that will take us through 2020. And then towards the end of 2020, we'll begin planning for 2021. But, you know, our focus remains on advertising and news content. And I don't expect us to get into any kind of areas, you know, we're not going to get into dramas or comedies, or we're not going to start a TikTok or anything like that.
I see. And my favorite part of Cheddar is actually the YouTube videos. Like, it's...
Yeah, the explainers. Yeah, somebody else was saying that to me yesterday. Yes.
What started that idea, and how do you hope to expand it?
Yeah, what started that idea was that's what YouTube wants. You know, YouTube, and the YouTube algorithm does not want clips of guests that were on Cheddar. The YouTube algorithm wants, you know, things that are 8 to 10 minutes long that explain an idea, and that's what people consume, and that's what the algorithm favors. And so for us, it's always a question of taking... what's the content we want to create? What does Cheddar stand for? And then tweaking it to work on the platform, to play by the platform's rules. If you just put what you want on these platforms, it won't necessarily work because they're so coded by algorithm, basically.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And sure. A final note that the information for the Ambassador Center is on the chat group. If you have a chance, please donate or contribute and then learn about the Ambassador Center. I think your dad said, always be the last person to talk. So John, provide some last words.
No, I think he said, no. What he always says is, that when you're at a cocktail party, okay, and you're talking to people, always be the one to end the conversation, because the other person wants to move on to talk to somebody else. And if you are just keep going, you're kind of giving the person the gift of their time back. So with that, I think I'll do just that. This was a pleasure, and I hope you guys all learned something. And I'm a big fan of Penn, so thank you for all that you do, and thank you for contributing to the Basser Center. And I hope everybody has a good summer. And that's all I got.
Thank you so much for listening, and a special thank you to the Penn Innovators and Business team, including Grace Wu, Erica Liu, Victor Chen, and Jessica Ramses. I'm your host, Christopher Rathbun, and keep innovating.